confess that my first thought when I looked at the readings for today was, didn't we just have a reading about the bread of heaven last week? Well, I guess it must be important or something if we're discussing it 2 weeks in a row. Indeed, chapter 6 in John is where we find the fourth gospel's Eucharistic theology. You will recall there is no institution of the sacrament of the bread and wine as Jesus' body and blood at the Last Supper. Rather, in John, Jesus washes the disciples' feet and gives them his farewell discourse. So it is here in chapter 6 that John makes clear his understanding of Jesus as the bread that has come down from heaven. Even though I will be distributing this bread later, it has not always been an easy relationship for me. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church, where we only received communion a few times a year, and we stayed in our pews as the bread and wine were passed along to us. So coming to the altar to receive every week was a big adjustment for me in my 30s. My first Sunday in the Episcopal Church was Palm Sunday in 1994, and the next Sunday was Easter, so of course we had communion again. But after a few weeks, I began to wonder, why are we still doing communion? Are we on some sort of a 7-week cycle or something? And so I whispered one Sunday, how long are we going to keep doing communion? And I received a perplexed look and a reply, we do it every Sunday. Every Sunday, I replied. I said, that's nuts. And I remember I used to debate with myself about whether I was going to go up to receive. I had to recount my week and figure out if I was worthy enough, or whether I better not, or whatever. And it wasn't until I was in seminary, and I had all but put away my trepidation around Holy Communion, when I received a phone call from a dear friend of mine, John, whose mother was dying of cancer. And we used to go to their house on Nantucket Island every summer. And my friend John's mother was now sick, and John was visiting her and telling her that I was at an Episcopal seminary. And she asked him to call me so that she could talk to me. Hi, Mrs. Deans. Hi, Berkeley. I just wanted to tell you how excited I am to hear that you're at an Episcopal seminary. And I said, well, that's wonderful. She said, you know, I took you to your first Episcopal church. You did not, I replied, sure that she had me confused with someone else. Oh, yes, I did, on Nantucket. Mrs. Deans, we were doing a lot of things on Nantucket, but going to church wasn't one of them. Oh, yes, she replied, Midge and I were downstairs in the kitchen, dressed for church, and you came down and asked what we were doing. And we told you, and you asked if you could come with us. I did not. But interestingly, as she said that, I was actually able to visualize that scene and that memory of coming down the stairs and seeing them in the kitchen. Yes, we waited for you to get dressed, and you came with us. But I always remember it was the oddest thing, because you sat in the back and you wouldn't come up for communion. I thought, maybe it was me. And in that moment, I was able to recall being in an old New England church where the ceiling was actually the inside of an old upside-down ship. So if that's the Episcopal Church on Nantucket, I suppose she was right, and I was there. Lorraine's nodding her head. The point is, we often never know where that true spark is that starts us on our journey. So how did I overcome my fear of bread? Well, I'm not sure I can pinpoint it for you, but what I can tell you is that this experience and others like it have been very important very important part of my formation for ministry. You see, my ministry has always gravitated toward those who, like me, felt left out. Now, given my context as a privileged straight white male, you might find it odd that a primary feeling for me has been the sense of being left out. But I can assure you that is how I have felt for much of my life. And I have come to realize over time that my ministry has been shaped by this sense of not being included. Virtually every aspect of my ministry has been to those who have been left out or have felt left out. The earliest memory I have is a wiffle ball game after church on Easter Sunday growing up, where I was pitching and had organized the game and made sure to include a younger boy who had leukemia. Years after he died, his parents still remembered how excited he had been to have been able to participate in that game. Or the multiracial field at Parish I sought out and served back in Massachusetts. Or the prison ministry work I did in seminary. Or my lay ministry in Vermont to the elderly. Or my call to campus ministry and outreach to the LGBTQ community at Cal Poly. At all turns, my ministry has gone to the places where people are feeling left out on the margins or excluded. And the reason I'm sharing all of these examples is because I realized as I was preparing this sermon that the turning point in my relationship with the Eucharist came because of some unchurched middle school girls who came on a junior high retreat to Rock Point, the diocesan retreat center in Vermont I mentioned in my last sermon. See, I told you this was an important place. Anyway, I was serving as a chaperone for this group of middle school students in 1998 at the diocesan junior high event. Unbeknownst to me, however, they weren't Episcopalian, and a few of them had never even been to church. They were all fine, though, and having a good time, but it wasn't until we got into the chapel for Saturday afternoon Eucharist that they all of a sudden became very concerned about what was going to happen in the service. And I was confused because they had already attended evening prayer on the night before and morning prayer that morning, and there hadn't been any issues. "What is this service?" they asked me. And I said, "It's our church service." And they were like, "But do we have to do anything?" And I was like, "No." And I opened the prayer book to show them, and I started showing them the service. And then we do this reading here, and then there's the peace, and I turned the page, and there were the words, "The Holy Communion." And I was like, "Oh, well, actually, we do something." And I started to explain about the bread and the wine becoming the body and blood of Christ, and their eyes just got really big. And it was like they stopped breathing or something. So I sought to reassure them I would tell Marcia, the celebrant, who was also the youth coordinator for the diocese, and make sure that she knew, so that she would say something, and I did that, and I came back, and I reassured them some more. And they were sitting there, and I could hear them whispering back and forth, "Are you going to do it? I don't know. Are you going to do it? I'm not going to do it." And I felt so bad for them, but I also understood what they were going through, because I had experienced it myself. Ultimately, they did go up, because the only thing more mortifying than going up when you're in eighth grade is not going up and standing out like that. After the service, though, I felt a voice very strongly telling me that I needed to address with them what had happened. And we had time before dinner, so we went down to the edge of Lake Champlain to the shore. We watched the sunset behind the Adirondacks. It was gorgeous. And then we gathered them in a room, and I began to teach them about the last week of Jesus' life. Good Friday, the crucifixion, Easter, and, of course, the Last Supper. Some knew some of the details, and others didn't. But I found out later from their leader, Denise, that they were really appreciative that I had cared enough to to take the time to do that with them. They all said how cool it was, Denise told me. And one of them later that night actually called me a role model. Well, that had never happened before. And so it was the next morning at Rock Point when I awoke and was lying there in bed that that voice of inner wisdom that we often speak about came to me. And I really received my call to ministry. You see, I didn't know these young people because they were from a neighboring town, and I hadn't been able to get any of our youth to come on the trip because we didn't have a youth group, because I didn't think that I had the necessary qualities to lead a youth group. And I could assist. I was fine assisting, but I didn't want to lead. And so when I made that argument, the voice said, well, I think we settled that yesterday. And so then my next pushback was, well, but I'm too busy. You know, I have all these other ministries. I couldn't possibly have the time to run a youth group. Well, the voice said, you can quit everything else. And I sat there and I thought about it. And I realized that my term on the vestry was going to be ending and they would probably want me to serve again, but I could say no. And then it was very liberating. I was realizing I could start saying no to all of these things, because if I were running the youth group, that would be sufficient. And it would also, it would be quite time consuming. And so that's what happened. That is what, when I got back on Monday, I called our rector and I did tease him a little bit. I called him on the phone. How was the weekend? It was fine. I said, but I have to tell you something. I said, I'm quitting everything. And he just listened for a minute, and there was silence, but then he said, oh, okay. And then I told him, I said, but I'm going to run the youth group. And he said, oh, okay. So where does this leave us? As I always try to remember to ask when I preach, where is the good news in all of this? For me, it's that Christ takes our frailties and our weaknesses and uses them to guide us and shape our lives and our ministries. I understand that faith isn't about knowing, it's about trusting and believing, but I can tell you this, I know that that bread has transformed me. Because there is no way, given the story that I just told you, that I'm standing here on my own. It's the bread of life. It's the bread that has come down from heaven that has shaped, molded, and formed me for ministry. Think about it. God took my fear, my anxiety, my sense of not belonging, and a feeling like an outsider who was unworthy. God took all of those attributes and used them to reach out to those students, to guide me to and connect me with God's people on the margins. And it's there that I found my calling. Because if I hadn't struggled, I might not have had the awareness to enter into the students' discomfort that day. And the call to work with young people might never have come. I realize it's not always easy to give thanks for what we perceive as our frailties and shortcomings, but they're a vital part of our journey into Christ. My message today is that it is the same for each and every one of us. Don't lament your perceived shortcomings. Honor the journey. Bring all of yourself with you and keep coming to the table, trusting that God will continue to find ways to shape, mold, and form you for ministry, using exactly whatever it is that you bring here with you. How shall we eat the bread of life today? Let us eat it mindfully. And to do so, I will once again use the words of Thich Nhat Hanh to guide us. In his meditation on the Eucharist, he says, Her writes, "The practice of the Eucharist is a practice of awareness. When Jesus broke the bread and shared it with his disciples, he said, 'Eat this. This is my flesh.' He knew that if his disciples would eat one piece of bread in mindfulness, they would have real life. Practicing mindfulness enables us to be a real person. To me, the rite of the Eucharist is a wonderful practice of mindfulness. In a drastic way, Jesus tried to wake up his disciples." Let us pray. Lord, we give you thanks for this gift, the gift of this bread, the gift of yourself, which you have left here with us. May we continue to trust that in receiving it, you will continue to work in and through our lives and bring us to that heavenly kingdom where you live and